Turn this morning to our series of sermons on the book of Galatians. We're reading this morning from Galatians chapter 4. We're going to read the first 20 verses. Our text is verses 8 through 11. Galatians 4, beginning at verse 1. Now I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, differeth nothing from a servant, though he be Lord of all, but is under tutors and governors until the time appointed of the Father. Even so we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. And because ye are sons, God hath sent forth the Spirit of his Son into your hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Wherefore thou art no more a servant, but a son, and if a son, then an heir of God through Christ. Howbeit then, when ye knew not God, ye did service unto them which by nature are no gods. But now, after that ye have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto ye desire again to be in bondage? Ye observe days and months and times and years. I am afraid of you, lest I have bestowed upon you labor in vain. Brethren, I beseech you, be as I am, for I am as ye are. Ye have not injured me at all. You know how through infirmity of the flesh I preached the gospel unto you at the first. And my temptation which was in my flesh he despised not, nor rejected, but received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. Where is then the blessedness he spake of? For I bear you record that if it had been possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and have given them to me. Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? They zealously affect you, but not well. Yea, they would exclude you, that ye might affect them. But it is good to be zealously affected always in a good thing, and not only when I am present with you. My little children, of whom I travail in birth again until Christ be formed in you, I desire to be present with you now and to change my voice, for I stand in doubt of you. Read God's holy and inerrant word to that point. Our text is verses 8 through 11. Howbeit then, when ye knew not God, ye did service unto them which by nature are no gods. But now, after that ye have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto ye desire again to be in bondage? Ye observe days and months and times and years. I am afraid of you, lest I have bestowed upon you labor in vain. Beloved of God, the Apostle Paul, in chapters 3 and 4 of the book of Galatians, has been defending justification by faith alone. He's been doing that with 8 distinct and clear arguments. This morning, we conclude the 6th of those 8 arguments, an argument that he started making back in chapter 3, verse 24. That is, the argument that is based on the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. As we said last time, the apostle had been arguing for justification by faith alone on the basis of the unity of the Old Testament and New Testament. It's one covenant. And Abraham in the Old Testament was justified by faith alone. Therefore, we are in the New Testament as well. Now he's arguing the same thing, but from the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Namely, that in the Old Testament, God's people were little children, and in the New Testament, God's people are those children grown up. We are adult sons and daughters, and that explains why all the rules have fallen away. The Old Testament civil and ceremonial laws were needed for them in the Old Testament because they were children. And for children, you have all kinds of rules and laws, specific applications of the principles that are at the heart of your home life that you apply to your children. But now, the apostle says, in the New Testament, that falls away. We experience a higher, more exalted sonship. Now that Christ has come and has sent the Spirit of Himself into our hearts, the Spirit of adoption, crying, Abba, Father, just as when that child grows up. All of those rules fall away, but the central principles stand and live in his heart and govern his life. So too, now for the church, grown up, the moral law stands. But those Old Testament civil and ceremonial laws fall away. And if they fall away, we can't be justified by obeying them. And if the covenant is one, and we're not justified by obeying those civil and ceremonial laws because they've fallen away, even though those laws stood in the Old Testament, they weren't justified by obeying them either. Now in our text, the apostle, coming to the end of that argument, now applies this urgently to the Galatians. This truth that the New Testament church is grown up in its sonship. And he applies it with some strong emotion. You were once pagans, and you've been brought out of that bondage of idolatry to the heights of sonship as I preach the gospel to you. And now, by allowing yourselves to be convinced by these Judaizers who've come in, you've been brought back under the same bondage. You just exchanged one prison cell for another. And the apostle says he can hardly believe it. How turn ye again? You can imagine him shaking his head as he's writing this. How turn you again into this bondage? That's the theme this morning. How turn ye again to bondage? Let's notice first two cells, two prison cells. Second, one key to deliver from both cells. And third, let's observe our natural love of the prison. How turn ye again to bondage? Two cells, one key, our natural love of the prison. The Galatian churches were made up of mostly Gentile converts from the Greco-Roman pagan religion. Some of those were converts to Judaism already before the Apostle Paul came to Galatia, and they converted to Christians from there. And there were Jewish converts to Christianity who were part of these Galatian churches as well. But it seems that the majority were Gentile converts. Paul and Barnabas had gone to Galatia on their first missionary journey, and many of the Gentiles had believed. And Paul now, in verse 8, reminds them of the bondage to pagan religion out of which they had been delivered. And it's beneficial for us to know that bondage too, though we were never a part of pagan religion, because the natural state is the same. It's this, verse 8, that we know not God. Howbeit then, when ye knew not God. This is the natural state. A people who do not know God. Cut off from him. Doesn't mean know nothing about God. What the apostle says here does not contradict what he writes in Romans 1, verses 19 through 21, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, speaking of the unregenerate. For God hath showed it unto them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. All human beings know something about God, his power, his divinity. They can name a few attributes of God to you in an unregenerate, unbelieving state. But knowing some things about God and knowing God are two different things. They don't know him in any saving way. This is all men. This is you and me by nature. Ephesians 4:18, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart, were cut off from him, ignorant, blind to any saving knowledge of him. He's a distant figure that we know is very powerful somewhere out there. But we're blind and ignorant of him, and what we do know about him, we run away from, we despise, and we turn him into something else in our own mind because we're scared of him. So that the result of this not knowing God, the apostle says, is bondage. Bondage. Howbeit then, when ye knew not God, ye did service unto them which by nature are no gods. We're scared of him, what we do know about him somewhere out there distantly. And so we turn him into something else, and then we worship that. Man is a worshiping being. He cannot but worship something. He fools himself if he tells himself otherwise. And he runs away from that distant figure, and he turns him into something else. And he serves this something else instead, and becomes a slave to that, whatever it was. For the Galatians, it was idols of wood and stone. And the Apostle Paul describes that service to those idols as bondage in verse 9 when he says, you desire again to be in bondage again, because they were in bondage at the first. A bondage of two things. First of all, it's the bondage of works righteousness, of working your way into this replacement God's favor, of being justified by works. Every man-made religion has this at its heart, works righteousness. I must earn his love for me. And pagan Greco-Roman religion was the same. Appease the gods by what you do, and there's always more to do. Make this offering and that offering in order to get this God off of your back, in order to earn his love for a little bit of time. So it was the bondage of works righteousness, always trying to earn favor and to not be destroyed. And second, it was the bondage of a relationship to this God that was characterized by that works righteousness, and so was driven utterly by fear. Void of anything of the fatherhood of God, void of the joy of sonship. No communion, no delight, no comfort, no fatherly and sonly walking and talking together. Any sense of sanctification or perseverance in this religion was cold and ritualistic and external. The relationship of a slave to a cruel taskmaster. He was always on your back with a club, beating you, do more, do more. Avoid my anger, avoid this hit, do this and that. Bondage. And Paul says, you Gentile believers in Galatia, you've been delivered from this. God sent us here to you to preach the truth of the gospel. And the Spirit brought you out of this darkness into his marvelous light, into a glorious truth of salvation by grace alone in Jesus Christ alone. And God had sent his sovereign power along with this and taken you powerfully out of this bondage, brought you to himself in a relationship of sonship. And yet now, not even a year later, I'm getting reports that these Judaizers have come and they've been teaching you and preaching to you and undermining me, and you've been buying it wholesale. You're not resisting them. And they've brought you back into the exact same bondage, just in a different way. The bondage of legalistic Judaism. How turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto you desire again to be in bondage? Those weak and beggarly elements are the same as the elements of the world in verse 3. You remember we saw that last time where the apostle says, even so we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world, the elementary things, the Old Testament system of its basic elementary teaching and its laws, its rituals, its civil and ceremonial laws that hemmed the saints in, necessary for them back then as children, but bondage for the adult sons now, weak and beggarly, impoverished, unable to help you. Because now that Christ has come, to be under that system again is to be under a bondage. It's one thing for children to have all those rules explicitly laid out. It's helpful for them. They need them. It's a certain kind of bondage that is necessary. But when you're an adult son, to have to go back to that kind of a life where you're told what to do every moment and what to eat and what not to eat and how to dress with every last detail everywhere you turn, that's bondage for an adult. You've come to maturity. You know the heart of the principles of God's house. And that's what these Judaizers have done. They've put them back into that bondage. And then another level, as the Judaizers have said, and this is how you earn it. This is how you earn your justification before God. And they took the gospel of grace out of it, a gospel of grace that was there in the Old Testament for them as little children. They sucked that out of it so that it's a whole other layer of bondage, of works righteousness. Do this and live. You see, this is how the apostle can compare the bondage of paganism to the bondage of what the Judaizers have been preaching. You ask yourself that question when you read the text. How can he use that word again in reference to two different things? How turn ye again? They're in bondage to paganism, and now under the Judaizers, he says, you're turning again to bondage. It's because it's the exact same thing. It's the same prison, just a different cell. It's works righteousness, earning the favor of God, no different from paganism. Never knowing that you are at peace with him. Appease me by what you do. Appease me by what you do. Always on your back, beating you with a club. Stop me from beating you. Do this and do that, and I'll stop. And therefore, the bondage of a relationship to God that is driven by this and this utter terror that's empty of sonship and fatherhood, that becomes all external, where it's pure rote duty. There's duty in our relationship to God, of course. In a right way, too, but it's a duty driven by love and gratitude. We discipline ourselves, but out of love and gratitude, the duty of a son who wants to please his father. But there was none of this in the doctrine of the Judaizers. It was Pharisaistic, outward, religion void of sonship. In every religion of man, whether it's all-out paganism, whether it's legalistic Judaism, whether it's any other ism, whether it's apostatizing Christianity that's fallen into a legalism, they're all the same. In the garden before the fall, God gave Adam law. And Adam was a perfect son. God said, keep living with me, and you will keep knowing this sonship. And Adam could because he was perfect, but then he fell. But that law didn't stop. The law remains. So that every human being who's born into this world, though he doesn't know anything about it, he feels it. He's born under that law. Obey. Obey. Do this and live. And that's why naturally, when man thinks about God, he always thinks this way. I must obey in order to earn his favor. I have to do this or do that. And even utter secular Americans who know nothing, if you ask them something, they will always say, well, I'm a pretty good person. I do enough. Because it's in all of us, born under that law. And this is why Christ himself, the Apostle Paul says, when he was born into this world, was born under the law. It's the law from Adam in the garden. And so this pops up in every religion, every world religion. It's the religion of man. It all has this at its heart. Works righteousness and your relationship to God is external. Do this and do that. And you must earn it. The apostle points to one aspect of the Old Testament system that the Judaizers were imposing upon these Galatian believers, and that was imprisoning them in a works righteousness mentality. In verse 10, you observe days and months and times and years. It wasn't only circumcision that they were forcing upon them, or the dietary food laws. It was also the whole calendar. Days and months and years and seasons that you must go through and keep going through year after year in order to earn your salvation. Days would refer to the days for fasting. Months would refer to especially the new moon celebrations referred to in Isaiah 66, verse 23. Seasons refers to the feast days, Passover, Feast of Tabernacles. They had a holiday season too. And years refers to the seventh year Sabbath and to the year of Jubilee every 50 years. But none of them are referenced to the regular weekly Sabbath. And that's important. I was going to preach this text when we hit the pause button on the fourth commandment as we went through the Heidelberg Catechism. But I knew this was coming up in our series on Galatians, and so I refrained and just make mention of it now. Because verse 10 is a text about which some people say, the Apostle Paul is here saying that the weekly Sabbath of the fourth commandment is part of this bondage that he's saying falls away. That this is part of what the Judaizers were placing upon the Galatians and that they shouldn't have. And Paul says, no, you're wrong to observe the weekly Sabbath. And that he says something similar in Colossians 2, verse 16. Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in respect to an holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath days. And that the Heidelberg Catechism is wrong when it calls Sunday the Sabbath day of the New Testament. But beloved, the Apostle Paul is not referring to the weekly Sabbath day of the fourth commandment here as part of the bondage of the system the Judaizers were putting upon the Galatians. The words Paul uses are in reference to the civil and ceremonial laws. You can see that, for example, when you look back at 2 Chronicles 31, verse 33. He, that is Hezekiah, appointed also the king's portion of his substance for the burnt offerings, to wit, for the morning and evening burnt offerings, and the burnt offerings for the Sabbaths, plural, and for the new moons, and for the set feasts, as it is written in the law of the Lord. Same words in the Greek version of Colossians 2, verse 16. It's clearly a reference specifically to the civil and ceremonial laws, not to the fourth commandment of the moral law of God. Which fourth commandment Christ himself upheld, as we saw in that series when we pushed the pause button. And as Paul upheld himself. Don't forget that there were more Sabbath days than the weekly Sabbath of the fourth commandment in Judaism. There are all kinds of Sabbath days, plural. And that's what the apostle is referring to. Those Sabbath days, plural, not the Sabbath day, singular. That falls away. The fourth commandment is still the moral law of Jehovah God. It was in effect from the beginning, before the civil and ceremonial laws were given. Just like marriage, it's a creation ordinance. It's housed in the moral law, the Ten Commandments. That's not the bondage. But the laws specific to Old Testament Israel were the bondage. And the Judaizers were keeping this upon the Galatians and saying, this is the way you earn your righteousness before God. And there is only and ever one key to open the door on the cells of that prison. And it's the key of God's glorious and gracious covenant. Howbeit, when ye knew not God, ye did service unto them which by nature are no gods. But now, after that you have known God, or rather are known of him, turn ye again. That's the heart of God's covenant. To know the true God. Does anyone remember the first question and answer of the Essentials Catechism book? Young people, young adults, do you remember? Any adults remember from your catechism days? What is above all things most precious to you? The very first thing that you're asked, the knowledge of the true God through Jesus Christ, whom he has sent, an answer that comes from John 17, verse 3. And this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. Above all things, most precious. What's precious to you? Your money? This experience or that experience? If I could only have this different in my life, boyfriend, girlfriend, vacation, to know him. To not be bound to create false idols of him, but to know the God who made all of this and who made me in a relationship of intimacy and love. Above all things, most precious. That he would grant his grace to me to break me out of that bondage and reveal himself to me so that he's not a God who's far off, but a God who is nigh. And put in my heart his own life that I might know him. Know him, but not merely the knowing, of course, that's a knowledge of facts. Although there must be a knowledge of facts, but a knowledge of facts that leads me into a relationship, and a relationship that makes me want to know more facts, and it keeps going and going, just like a relationship with a friend or a husband and a wife. A relationship of intimacy, a vital living bond, personal, individual, supernatural, dynamic, a living friendship, the communion of the sharing of persons. I can know the Pythagorean theorem, but there's no life there. In this knowledge, there is life. This is the sweetest thing in all the world. Is there anything that is a greater joy to you than this? To know the great, holy, majestic, sovereign, powerful being this way. That's his covenant. Psalm 25, verse 14. The secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will show them his covenant. Where you know, perhaps, that word secret. The secret of the Lord is with them that fear him. Is a word that means secret speech, intimate speech that you only tell a really close friend or a husband or a wife, pillow talk. Things you say at night on your bed, your husband or wife, he tells me his secrets. He opens up a whole world to me in his word. This is the only thing I can make my boast in. It's the only thing I want to make my boast in. Jeremiah 9, verses 23 and 24. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me. Some of us can't wait to boast about our money or about our job or to boast about what we know and to reveal it at every chance. Some of us can't wait to boast about our power. But the prophet says, boast in nothing except this, that you get to know me. What can compare to that? And yet, of course, because the Apostle Paul is a sovereign grace man, he doesn't leave it at knowing God, but adds the explanation in verse 9, or rather, are known of God. But after that ye have known God, or rather, are known of God. It was not I that found, O Savior, true. No, I was found of thee. I sought the Lord, and afterward I knew. He moved my soul to seek him by seeking me. But by the grace of God, I am what I am. But if any man love God, 1 Corinthians 8, verse 3, the same is known of him. If any man love God, that's the fruit. The same is known of God. That's the root. God has known him, and therefore he knows and loves him. Paul knew his theology, and he knew his theology in his own life. How it worked out in his own case. On his way to Damascus, Christ came to him and apprehended him. I know you, Saul. And he didn't say, Paul, I just want you to know that I'm out here. This distant figure who's out here. And here I am waiting, Paul, for you to come to know me at some point. I want you to, but there's nothing I could do about it. He invaded Paul's life. He didn't knock on the door and wait. He charged and knocked down the door and took Paul to himself. Out of Paul's natural blindness, And he cried out to him, "Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? I know you, Saul. I've known you from all eternity, and I call my own by name. And I'm coming to tell you I know you. I know what you're doing. I know why you're doing it. You're kicking against the pricks. But I'm going to come take you to myself, Saul." Paul was known already from eternity. That's what struck him. He knew me. And he gave me to know him. That's why it's in the passive, you see. Or rather, are known of God. God's activity before ours. We're passive. And he actively knows us, and that leads to the activity of knowing him. It's the foreknowledge of God of Romans 8. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate. To notice, of course, that it does not say, and what he did foretell. As though he foretold that you were going to have, but whom he did foreknow. He knew us in his own mind in a relationship of love. He's chosen us, whom he's known. Not just a number picked out of a hat, but persons that he created to be his friends. In a particular love of a bridegroom for his bride, so that you might know the uniqueness and the specialness of this intimate knowledge. So that he says in Amos 3, verse 2, "You only have I known of all the families of the earth." And this in John 10, verse 27, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." I know them, and that's why they come and follow me. He knows about the ungodly, just like the ungodly knows some things about him, but he doesn't know them like this. Matthew 25, 11 and 12. "Afterward came also the other virgin, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, Verily I say unto you, I know you not." Doesn't that make you tremble? If he would ever say that to you, "I know you not." But he doesn't. He says, "From eternity I knew you. I've known you all through your life. And my knowing of you is bringing you a knowledge of me." God has been utterly intentional in the establishing of his covenant. Make no mistake about it. There's no misfiring. It's not the blasting of a nozzle on the end of a hose that's set on shower mode, but it's set on jet mode, and it's aimed at every single one, and it reaches its target, and it draws unto himself, so that the child of God cries out under this as a son before his father, "Abba, Father, you knew me, and I know you." So that when he feels that his father is far away, he says things like Psalm 63, 1 and 2, "My soul thirsteth for thee, my flesh longeth for thee, in a dry and thirsty land where no water is, to see thy power and thy glory." When we're kept away from worship, or we're close to him in a unique way, the child of God says in Psalm 84, "My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God." And when we're close to him, out of the satisfaction of the soul that is, we cry out, "Thy loving kindness is better than life. My lips shall praise thee." When we're chastised of him, as a father who loves his children chastises them, and we are tempted to give up under that and to fall down and not get up, we remind ourselves that he's a father. "Have ye forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as children? My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth." I say, my father's doing what he needs to do. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptation. And I walk with him, and the deeper I know him, I cry out with Moses in Exodus 33, show me your glory, God. That will satisfy my soul. This is life. Without this, there is nothing. And this is the key that unlocks the cell door, the bondage to works righteousness. But now, howbeit then, when ye knew him not, you were in bondage. But now, after that you have known God, or rather, known of him, to hear from him in the depths of the soul, I knew you, child, from eternity. In love, I've revealed myself to you. And though you're born under that law, so that you always think, do this and live, earn this and live and not die, I sent my son, Jesus Christ, under the law, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, so that my relationship to you would not be one where you're earning it, where I'm on your back beating you, but one of a father to a son. The life that I take you into is not a life of cold slavery. But in my own house, there's nothing like it in all the world. It's the key that delivers from bondage. And the apostle knows that it's going to be the same key. And once delivered these Galatians from that bondage of paganism, that's going to deliver them from the bondage of legalistic Judaism too. That's why he writes it to them here in this epistle. You are sons. You are sons. You've been released from that bondage. You are the children of God, grown up into maturity, into a greater sonship, the spirit of adoption granted to you. You don't live under that bondage of the Old Testament anymore. And not only that, certainly, you don't earn it by those laws or by the moral law either. It's adoption. And your relationship to God is not a cold relationship of simply obeying rituals of days, months, and years in order to get him off your back or to stop him from beating you. Remember what you've been given in the gospel of grace. And then you take his law the right way too, and you discipline yourself, yes, and you obey out of love and gratitude. Paul knows this will be the key to deliver them again. And it did. The apostle writes this on, really in between his first missionary journey and his second. But there is a second. And there is a third. He's going to go back to these churches, and there's churches who've been delivered from this. This word preserved them, and it always preserves God's true people. It unlocks the door, the bondage to legalism. In whatever form it comes, restores us out of that prison, once again into the knowledge of sonship and adoption and grace. Always, this is the key. And while it's flabbergasting to the Apostle Paul, these Galatians would turn again to this bondage, he knows what they need. There is a certain, I can't believe it in this text. How is it, after you've been delivered from this prison, that and you've came to know God and this sonship to him, You could feel the Apostle Paul's amazement. How could anybody want to go back into this bondage after being in Father's house? And he's thinking to himself, well, maybe there's some of them who really weren't delivered. Verse 11, I'm afraid for you, lest I have bestowed labor on you in vain. Lest you didn't actually understand or understand and know the gospel at all in this relationship with God. Maybe there were some, but the majority would be restored through the use of Paul's epistle, his good pastoral work here. And the fact that he knows that if they are his, this key will unlock the door. It will. It will. And just as Paul had to preach it again in this letter to the Galatians, it has to be preached again and again to you and to me. Because, beloved, there's a natural tendency in us to love this prison. It's comfortable to us. Having been born under this law from Adam, it's in us. It's in our old man. Quite strongly, look at the word the Apostle Paul uses in verse 9, whereunto ye desire again to be in bondage. A willing desiring, a wish of purpose. There's still that in us. That innate natural thinking, I must earn it. And there's still a certain comfort to these prison cells. And maybe a new cell, oh, that's interesting, but it's still the same prison, comfortable. Always we need these truths of the gospel preached and the wonder of it and the inflaming of the mind and heart of the new man at the glories of this covenant God. Keep us, to preserve us. The level of the heart outward into this sonship and the graces of adoption. Deliverance from bondage into the glorious liberty of the sons of God. Amen. Father, preserve us in thy word. We're thankful for the truth of thy covenant. Grant us this life with thee. In Jesus' name, amen.